Welcome to the History of the Cold War podcast, Cold War 2.0, Episode 12, the one-year anniversary. As always, this episode is recorded on or about February the 16th, and all of our information and stories as relates to this episode are all based on that time period. So obviously events might have fluctuated and when you heard this, and events or topics might have changed. We're just relying on open source information, like everybody else, to draw our conclusions to make this episode. This episode, as always, is informed by your host, Jeff Hoag's understanding of history, specifically late 20th century history and the Cold War. This is our short episode. If you're interested in listening to the long, full episode, please become a Patreon member. Either through our website or at patreon.com/coldwarpodcast, where you can get access to the full episode. As always, I'm joined by our producer, David Force.
Hello, folks. And Jeff, thank you for that comprehensive introduction. With that, for today's episode, we're going to start off, of course, with the Ukraine and Russian war. From there, we're going to talk about some of the politics that are involved with that war, then move on to forced generation and how Ukraine and Russia are creating their ability to be able to project force on the battlefield. After that, we're going to be going into what those strategic attacks are against the forced generation. And then we'll dive into a review topic, the war in review, 1 year on. From there, we'll talk about what it looks like, where do we stand, and what has happened over the past year in the conflict. And then, of course, we'll talk about what it looks like potentially going forward. From there, we'll then turn our gaze to the east and look at Asia with some insights from Japan, China, and India. And so, with that, Jeff, could you please start us off with the current state of the war?
Sure. Yeah. So let's dive into what's been currently happening. So the war has, the last month or so, has been a slow grinding Russian offensive based in the Donbas in the east in an attempt to basically surround and take Bakhmut. At first, the last so many weeks, they were slowly advancing north and south of the city. Last month, they had taken Soledar, a city just north of Bakhmut. And now they're in the outskirts of the city. From the south, they were threatening the major road in and out of Bakhmut. And if this road falls, there would only be one road in and out of the city, which would be a minor road. However, in the past few days, the Ukrainians have counterattacked and have been pushing back the Russian forces around them. But the situation is still critical. Most of the troops fighting in and around Bakhmut are actually the Wagner mercenary group led by Prigozhin, or Putin's chef. And it's not going good for them either. Prigozhin actually was on TV, social media recently, and for Russian social media, he was complaining bitterly about how the Russian army and the Russian bureaucracy is basically refusing to help him, and that he doesn't think they're going to be now able to capture the city. Also, a part of this is that which we'll talk about later, is that they're no longer allowed to use or recruit Russian convicts, which has had detrimental effects to his strategy there. And a lot of this is tied to, which we've talked about the last couple episodes, the conflict between his group, the Wagner mercenary force, and the regular Russian army, and the dispute that they've had. Nevertheless, like I said, the situation is still fluid in Ukraine, and the Ukrainians are facing challenges of their own. Specifically, they're running out of ammunition and spare parts for their Soviet-era artillery and equipment, and it appears that they have exhausted most of the stocks of Soviet-era weapons and equipment from Eastern Europe. So they're basically racing to replace as many of these systems as possible with Western counterparts. Ukraine is also taking heavy casualties as they're not rotating troops or units off the battlefield, but instead, very similar to the U.S. Army in World War II, they're just replacing losses. So what's happening is members of the unit are being killed, and then those unit, they're just being sent replaces. They're not being rotated off the line. However, the Russians themselves are also taking very heavy losses. According to British intelligence, they're losing about 800 men a day. Basically, and this is coming from a combination of basically inexperienced troops. If you remember, a lot of these troops are a lot of these troops are brand new conscripts who have come in and who either have had little experience or no experience at all, and now are being thrown into combat situation. Even if they had gone through the 3 months of mandatory training, that's not a lot to really prepare someone for war. And we don't know the quality of this training either. So a lot of the other casualties it's coming from a lack of training, because they have an inability to, on the ground, they have an inability to coordinate attacks. The Ukrainians as well have laid large landmine fields, which makes it difficult for the Russians to advance and flank Ukrainian positions. And finally, the Ukrainians themselves are well dug into defensive positions, which in war, you know, typically the defender has an advantage. So there's been a significant uptick in fighting, according to British intelligence. And this is the highest level of casualties actually that the Russians have suffered since the very first weeks of the war. This 800 people a day figure is 4 times higher than what they were losing in July.
So, how accurate do you think those numbers are? I mean, 800 men a day, you're talking about, roughly 300,000 men a year.
Yeah, I mean, well, the momentum or the intensity of the conflict might at some point calm down or peter off, right? And normally, you know, there, like I said, over the summer, there wasn't as much offensive. Both sides were kind of in a holding pattern there for a little bit until the Ukrainians lost their offensive. So anytime you're on the offensive, most of the time, historically speaking, again, you'd expect to take higher casualties. I do think it's harder to gauge whether those numbers are accurate or not. But we'd have to believe that they're pretty high. Again, because unlike the kind of war that the U.S. experienced in the war on terror in regards to anti-insurgence operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, this is like high-intensity combat, right? Akin to Korea or some parts of Vietnam, right? You have a lot of artillery that's engaged in combat. You have a lot of mortars. You have frontal and flanking attacks, right? You have a very Western, straight-up type of combat, right? You have different formations engaging them each other, right? Large formations, you know, that are fighting on the battalion and even the divisional level, right? Who are running into each other. So these are very large engagements for the most part, something that we really haven't seen since the 20th century. So this is really 20th century warfare. So it would make sense that the casualties would be so high, especially because unlike, let's say, American or Western forces, I don't think they're probably either Ukrainians or the Russians are providing a high level of medical treatment to these troops as well, and especially as in regards to some of the tactics they're using. So, you know, last time you asked me about, how the Wagner group was using the convicts that they had were recruiting for a while into the Wagner fighting force, how are they utilizing these troops? So a lot's come out since the last month around that. So rumor has it that the Wagner group is basically using these prisoners to clear minefields. It's very similar to what the Soviets had done in World War II. So what they would do is they would tell them to advance into a certain area, 500 yards or so in a specific area, and then report back. Of course, they didn't tell them that they suspected that there might be a landmines in that location. But obviously sending them through that location, they would quickly find out if there were landmines in that area or not. Of course, this would be bad for the convict troops because some of them would be killed in the process. They would basically use them, these convicts again, to kind of probe the Ukrainian defenses for weak points that could be exploited. And then they could also use the convicts for frontal assaults, while more experienced Wagner mercenaries would flank the position, right? So basically, you send the convicts in for a frontal attack, And then the Wagner mercenaries would try to work around the sides or try to come in behind the exposed Ukrainians while they were trying to deal with the convicts.
So basically, they should be so lucky to be cannon fodder.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, like you said, you know, some of our suspicions that they might be used as cannon fodder totally played out to be true. And then another element of the story is that, you know, going back to the medical care and maybe part of the reason why they're suffering so many casualties is there are reports that Russian doctors, Russian army doctors, are refusing to treat these convicts. Basically because of their time in prison, many of them have AIDS, syphilis, or TB. So they're just being left to die, right? Once they're being wounded to a certain extent, and they need medical attention. Like I said, the reports, rumors are that many Russian doctors are just refusing to treat them because of these contagious diseases.
Wow. Okay. And then circling back really quickly to the Ukraine not rotating their troops, why would they need to rotate their troops? Why is that typical practice in militaries? It doesn't seem like they would need a trip to Disneyland or something like that. Why do they typically do this in war?
So yeah, there's a lot of different schools of thought over this over time. So some of the schools of thought would be that you pull a whole unit, one that's been engaged in combat, off the line to give them time to repair their equipment, to give them time to just take a breath. There are concerns about the psychological effects that it takes on troops for being on the front line for too long, right? If your unit's too experienced or experiences too much combat, you'll have a higher rates of PTSD. Which wears down, obviously, the unit's effectiveness, their ability to understand and take orders, their ability to comprehend orders. PTSD, I'm sure many people are aware, has a lot of effects, even in the short term versus the long term effects of these gentlemen, or even women in this case. So the idea is you want to try to pull back units and then send in replacements, and that other than keep them in the field. The advantage, of course, of keeping the unit in the field and just sending replacements is that obviously you don't have to worry. You're still maintaining force in that area, right? And you don't have to worry about changing in or changing out units. It just makes life a little bit easier for the commanding staff, right? And it just gives you higher availability of firepower and units to engage in operations if you're not pulling units off the front to rest. A lot of this pulling troops off the front to rest started actually in World War I. But like I said, the American Army in World War II didn't do this. They just, most of the time, there were rare occasions where they would pull units off the line to rest and refit, but most of the time they would just send replacements in to replace those that had been wounded or killed, and just keep going, right? So that's a lot of times, and you could see that in different series like Band of Brothers and such. You would just have replacements that would come in to replace the guys who had been wounded or killed. And although going back, the Russians are suffering horrific casualties, especially these convicts, they're basically trading the lives of these low quality Russian convicts for some of Ukraine's arguably best trained and more determined troops and foreign volunteers, because obviously these people are defending their homeland and or their foreign volunteers, right? So a lot of territorial troops. So it's not an even trade. One Russian convict, three or four Russian convicts for a motivated Ukrainian territorial soldier. It's not an equal trade in most instances. So that's another advantage the Russians are trying to use. They're trying to bleed the Ukrainians with this type of strategy. And it's also fundamental to what's happened really with the war effort. We are talking about, looking back over the past year, the Russian strategy has really changed a lot. If you remember from the beginning of the conflict, they had a lot of vehicles, a lot of armor, a lot of tanks, a lot of infantry fighting vehicles, but they didn't have a lot of infantry, especially infantry to protect those vehicles, right? So they really didn't have a combined arms process. And then now they went through a massive amount of equipment that was destroyed. And very similar thing with artillery, right? They were using, at one point, a massive, when the maneuver war ended, they were using massive amounts of artillery fire to try to conserve the lives of their troops that they had. Now it's kind of switch, where they're expending the lives of their soldiers, or these convicts in this case, very openly, very willingly, and they're trying to conserve their vehicles, their tanks, and their ammunition. However, like I mentioned earlier, it's been announced that Wagner will no longer be hiring prisoners to go fight for them. And it's not clear why this decision was made. There could be a couple of reasons for this. One could be that they're having other problems that we don't know with these convict troops. Many of them could be defecting over to the Ukrainians as soon as they get the chance. Or they could be trying to frag their Wagner officers. Frag means kill. So we don't know the types of problems they have had with these troops. Or they probably have low morale as well, especially when they find out that they're just being used to clear landmine fields. So the morale of these convict units are probably very low. And then also, I do think there's a political dimension where obviously the Wagner group was having a lot of success. And it was making the Russian army look bad. So the Russian army is probably working to behind the scenes to stop this from happening. There was a TV incident where they took a gentleman who they said had surrendered as a convict. And then Prigozhin, in this video, they execute the gentleman by using a sledgehammer on his head. And even in Russia, a lot of people... because he was executed because he did not want to follow orders. So even in Russia, a lot of people thought that this was wild. This is way too far. And there was kind of a pushback against it. So then later on, Prigozhin came out and basically said, hey, this was just a fake video that we did to scare people. And they even showed the guy was still alive. But it was just a bridge too far, right? So I think maybe that's another reason why they decided to stop giving them access to the convicts, especially with maybe some of these tactics that they were using the convicts for were just too wild. And, you know, more liberal, quote unquote, liberal elements of the Russian elite were like, this is too barbaric for us. We need to stop him from getting to use these convicts. It's not right. So there has been a stop to it. He can no longer, Prigozhin, that is, and the Wagner group, they can no longer recruit these prisoners. We'll see this to me seems like it might be a temporary measure. You know, if the war continues to go bad and the army under this current offensive doesn't work out, Putin might reexamine the situation and still go ahead and let them recruit these guys. But we'll see. Russia has also been using, and going back to the way that their tactics have been changing, they have been using drones as well to make their artillery fire just much more accurate. And again, to conserve ammunition, copying a lot of what Ukraine has been doing, because, you know, with the introduction of HIMARS and just the war going as long as it is, just like Ukraine, Russia, and like we've been talking about for months, Russia is trying to conserve the ammunition they have. They don't have as much as they used to. And the Wagner's also hired Chinese contractors, from what we understand, to operate and repair a lot of these drones in Ukraine. Beyond what's happening on the ground, the war in the air is still ongoing, of course, and Russia's strategic cruise missile strikes. We know that we suspect that Russia is running low on cruise missiles as they have resorted to using HK-22 anti-ship missiles. These missiles were actually designed back in the 1960s to sink American aircraft carriers, but they're using them against Ukraine to a devastating effect. And it's, you know, really an imprecise weapon. But overall, the Russian cruise missile raids have declined, indicating that, again, they're either trying to conserve their missiles that they have remaining, or they're trying to, and they're just using basically what they can produce and buy in terms of drones from Iran. Another weird event that's happened recently as well in the conflict is that Russia has deployed surface-to-air missile systems all over Moscow, including on top of a few government buildings, such as the Ministry of Defense, which is kind of funny because they've actually had to use a giant crane to lift this missile truck on top of the Ministry of Defense, as they now fear a drone or a cruise missile attack from Ukraine. So they're basically trying to prepare for attacks against Moscow, which again is another, says a lot about the state of where they're at in the war. But there, it hasn't all been bad news for Russia. One of the things that has kind of worked out in their favor is that SpaceX, which is headed by Elon Musk, has restricted the Ukrainian army's access to Starlink, the satellite communication system, which Ukraine has been using to control UAVs and drones. As they said that they don't want their technology to be used for offensive purposes. And of course, if you remember, Elon Musk has called on Ukraine to surrender large tracts of their territory and capitulate to Putin for peace, because for his fear that this could continue to escalate into a nuclear war. So he's basically put forward a policy, try to have appeasement, to try to get to have the war to end. At least that's his personal plan. And then finally,
thank you for joining us for Cold War 2.0, Episode 12, the shortened version. If you'd like to join us for a full episode, please join us at patreon.com/coldwarpodcast. If you did have any questions, comments, want to join us on social media, please go to our website. It's at www.historyofthecoldwarpodcast.com. While there, please fill out our survey so that you can help us to bring you a better show.